You're listening to TIP.
On today's show, we are super pumped to bring you our second part interview covering Bitcoin. Last week, we had Dr. Saifedean Ammous on the show, and he talked about some of the fascinating ideas like the stock to flow and time preference. But on today's show, we bring you another rising star within the Bitcoin community that complements much of Saifedean's work quite well because he put a lot of mathematics and statistics into the ideas of stock to flow. Our guest is an anonymous personality in the Bitcoin space, but he has experience as a quant in a multi-billion dollar international fund, and he goes by the name Plan B. This is a riveting discussion, and it will not take much time for people listening to this to realize that we're dealing with an extremely intelligent individual who's presenting some ideas that will undoubtedly give you a lot to think about after you're done listening to this episode. And so with that, here is Plan B.
You are listening to The Investors Podcast, where we study the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Preston Pysh. And as always, I'm accompanied by my co-host, Stig Brodersen. Today, we have Plan B with us, like we said in the introduction. Plan B, I'll tell you what, we have been chatting on Twitter. We've crossed paths, and it's just so exciting for me to be able to just talk with you and have a conversation for once.
Thanks for having me. And it's great to be on your show, man.
All right. So, hey, I want to start off just talking about a little bit of who you are, because some people that are listening to this are not familiar with your work. And a lot of our community is not hardcore crypto or Bitcoin background. They're actually value investors. So what I want to do is I want to give people an introduction to your background as a quant investor. So talk to us a little bit about that and how you found yourself in the Bitcoin community and in this Bitcoin world of ideas.
I'm based in Amsterdam. We manage a multi-billion dollar balance sheet, mainly focused on mortgages, fixed income, loans, and, well, the usual derivatives and structured finance products as well. I'm not a hardcore Bitcoiner myself and entered from a financial perspective. But of course, as an investor, the supply cap, the 21 million supply cap, jumped right to the foreground. And I was interested in that, how you can keep a cap like that in a digital world. So the digital scarcity thing was what hooked me from the start. I'm an investor. I like the story. I like the narratives, but I need the numbers. So there's a lot of numbers out there, but it's all TA, technical analysis, and not much solid statistical econometric analysis. That being my background, I thought that would be a spot that I could add and help at least the investor part of the Bitcoin community.
And that's what I really like about it, because whenever you talk about Bitcoin, one of the questions that always pops up is, so what's the value? Please tell the audience about your research.
I started with the numbers. Of course, Bitcoin is a different animal than the things I normally model. So there's no cash flow like a company or a fixed income instrument or a derivative. It's a bit like gold. It's just there. How do you value it? In fact, the same problem is there for gold as well, because you could, of course, look at the cost of mining of gold or Bitcoin. I just went with the digital scarcity idea. Also, after reading Saifedean Ammous's book, The Bitcoin Standard, he has a whole chapter in there about stock to flow. And stock to flow is, of course, also known in the commodities world, gold, silver. So I use that as that stock to flow measure as a quantification of the scarcity, and then use that as an input in a valuation model. So maybe for the listeners who don't know, stock is the reserve, the amount of Bitcoin or the amount of gold that's above the ground, that is just there. And flow is the yearly production. And then you just divide the two. Bitcoin, you have 17 or almost 18 million Bitcoins right now. 750,000 per year are added. That number is rapidly declining, by the way. But if you divide those two, you get a stock to flow multiple of 27. And what I discovered was that the stock to flow number is correlated with the market value. So for example, the stock to flow of gold is 55 or something, and the market value is about 10 trillion US dollars. If you put all those stock to flow numbers of all the commodities out there and put them on the line, you get this straight line. It's actually a power law with a super high R squared, super high correlation. It's just amazing. So there's actually two models out there. So there's the cross-asset model, where it all started with gold and silver and et cetera. But there's also the time series model, where you, if you plot the stock-to-flow time series of Bitcoin of the last 10 years against the market cap, you can also see the correlation there and measure the correlation. And it's also really high, like 95%.
Well, I know personally, whenever I read it, I was like, this is it. It's about time somebody has put what I felt was happening, but didn't know how to describe it, right? And I think a lot of people in the community had this intuition that what you were describing and what you were actually applying mathematics to was happening, but we just didn't know how to describe it. And so here you come into it and you start describing it. For people that are not familiar with R squared values, describe what this is. Describe what it means whenever you model something and then the actuals compared to what the projections were, what that means.
R squared is a statistical measure for goodness of fit of a model. So if a model fits really good to the data, like perfect fit, it has a high value, 100%. And if there's no fit at all, it's zero. If you look at the numbers for the cross-asset stock-to-flow model, 99.5%. That's like almost a perfect fit. That's amazing. I've never, ever seen that before. And if you look at the 95% of the time series stock-to-flow model, that's also very, very high. So it measures the amount of variance in the price, how much of that is explained by the amount of variance in the stock-to-flow. And in fact, it's not the most important measure. There are other measures, but it's a frequently used measure. So that's why I use it.
So you come up with this model, and this model explains using mathematics what the price of Bitcoin should be. And a lot of that has to do with the halving function. So could you please elaborate on what that is and also give us an idea of the estimated price levels depending on the year that we end?
The halving is a very important thing because every 210,000 blocks, that's about 4 years, the subsidy that miners get when they mine a block is halved. From an investor's point of view, the supply is halved. That doubles the stock-to-flow measure and increases the value as well. So especially those stepwise nonlinear function is very, very interesting because markets are anticipating on it. There's a lot of debate and narratives always around halvings. But if you look at the numbers, so we're now at a stock-to-flow of Bitcoin of 27, and that gives a value of about a little under $10,000. So we're about there, a little bit over right now. But after the halving, if the stock to flow doubles, that's in May 2020. So that's 8 months away. Very interesting, very, very awesome event. The stock to flow doubles, but the value of Bitcoin goes 8 or 10x, somewhere between, let me give a rough range, somewhere between 50 and 100K, starting somewhere after May next year. 4 years later, there's another halving in 2024. The stock to flow will go to 100, something we as humans have never seen before, spectacular moment in time. And the value that goes mathematically with an asset that has a stock to flow of 100 is somewhere between $400,000 and $1 million per Bitcoin.
When you say this has never happened in history, I just want people that are listening to this to understand what you mean by that. And what you're saying is because we've never had a digital asset that had scarcity. And that's what we're dealing with here because that's what blockchain technology provides, which is a decentralized fixed supply of a digital token. And because of this halving function, you're introducing this in the past. If you were mining gold, you can keep mining and pulling more gold out of the ground. But with Bitcoin, that noose is tightening with this halving function. And that's why you're seeing the stock to flow get so insanely tight. And we've never seen those kind of numbers before, like you described. And so you're suggesting that that's going to potentially create this situation where we see these very high prices on a digital fixed supply asset.
Yes. And I think people underestimate the speed at which this is going. The stock to flow will double to around the gold levels after May 2020. That means the market cap of Bitcoin will be around the same as, or a little bit under, but in the trillions, like $1 or $2 trillion. Compared to the monetary base of the US dollar, which is $3 trillion, that's already order of magnitude in the same range. 4 years later, 2024, stock to flow 100, and the market cap will be in the 10 or 20 trillion, that way above the US dollar. So it has all kinds of implications. We're not going there smoothly, I guess.
Now, I have to ask you, what is the end market cap for Bitcoin? Say that this goes all the way and replaces fiat currencies. And I'm not saying this is possible at all, but I think it's important to understand the impact of your model should this materialize. So for Bitcoin right now, we are around $180 billion. You mentioned gold's market cap before, around $8 trillion. What are we looking at here?
First of all, I think if we hit 10 trillion, 20 trillion market cap, that will be the point that your unit of account will change maybe. It wouldn't make sense to measure things in dollars. The model is in dollars as well, of course. So that would be the point in time where you have to think about measuring maybe in Bitcoin. If we look at the dollar world, like you said, derivatives, what is it, $500 trillion or bond market, $100, $200 trillion, I think. There's real estate. It's amazing. And all those markets have a monetary premium that's beyond the fundamental value those assets have. If you look at stocks, for example, the fundamental value of stocks, it's derived from dividends, but the dividend yield now is very, very low. Same with bonds, with the very low, even negative interest rates. What is the value of a bond like that? That's actually real world problems that we have to deal with as institutional investor. And look at real estate. Real estate is bought as an investment, especially in big cities like New York, London, Amsterdam. The value of living is also there, but the monetary premium, if you will, is bigger. I think the monetary premium will go to the asset that captures and holds it the best, and that will be Bitcoin. So it might as well trigger some very unintended consequences like stock markets and real estate markets losing that monetary premium.
So when we look at the market cap of Bitcoin today, and I think this is important because a lot of people that are participating in this are looking at it from a very myopic point of view, just because it's not something that they dedicate a lot of their time to. So they're looking at the price today and they're saying, wow, it's $10,700. That's really expensive for a Bitcoin, right? That's kind of the end of their analysis because they're looking at it from a very short-sighted point of view. But when you scope out and you hear those huge, huge numbers, those trillions of dollars, let's just say $10 trillion or $20 trillion, and you're looking at the market cap where it sits today. So if one Bitcoin is priced where it is today at $10,700, the market cap is only $192 billion. Now you're looking at, if we go 10x from here, that's $2 trillion. If you go 100x, now you're at $20 trillion. That's where the price, if you would see these numbers that Plan B's talking about, going up to a couple $100,000 or $1 million, that's how you get there from here, is because that market cap's going to go into the trillions instead of just being 200 billion like it is today. I love asking this question. What is an interesting conversation that you've had recently, maybe with some of your friends that are quants, or you're saying that you're getting some pretty interesting emails from some interesting folks that are in some very high places. Has there been a conversation or has there been an engagement that is at the top of your memory as being like, wow, is this really happening?
What amazes me most about a lot of the conversations I have with my traditional colleagues, if you will, not with the Bitcoin colleagues, is the level of misunderstanding. And even the people that are a bit positive, they don't really trust the high predictions made by the stock-to-flow model, for example. They just don't believe it. That's something that reminds me of the Black and Scholes model at the time. I really like that story. Black and Scholes won the Nobel Prize in economics. They invented in 1973 the option pricing model, and they put it out there. It was in public, or not much people understood it, not much people believed it. And basically, that was like 10 years of time to exploit the model while it was out in the open. That's also what's going to happen with the stock to flow now. People just don't believe it or don't know it or are so far behind. And that's what amazes me in all the discussions I have.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable heated and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com. Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe, or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meka.com. That's Meyka.com. The Holy Grail of Investing, the new book by Tony Robbins and co-written by investing legend Christopher Zook, reveals the secrets of alternative investments like private equity, venture capital, energy, real estate, sports franchises, and more. It features exclusive insights from investing titans who collectively manage more than $500 billion, including Robert F. Smith, Vinod Khosla, Michael B. Kim, and many others. In the Holy Grail of Investing, you'll discover how to take advantage of the trillions flowing into private equity by becoming an owner of firms that actually manage the assets and share in the revenue they generate, how to take advantage of the 2 to 3 times higher returns of private credit as an alternative or complement to bonds, how to invest in the energy evolution and ride the wave of trillions in global investments, how investments in private real estate can work as an inflationary hedge and source of tax-efficient income, and how many of the world's greatest investors thrive in both good times and bad. The Holy Grail of Investing by Tony Robbins is available now wherever books are sold.
All right, back to the show. So continuing on this, you have extensive experience with derivatives. Talk to us about what is happening to BACT. For those of you who are not familiar with BACT, it's the new exchange that the owners of the New York Stock Exchange are standing up right now. And could you also talk to us about why a derivatives market settled in Bitcoin are different than one settled in cash?
Yeah, great question, especially today since BACT is opening its warehouses today. Derivatives markets are very important because of the network effect for Bitcoin. It's one of the network effects. And it opens the market, it makes the market more attractive for institutional investors. Big investors are always on the lookout for a way to sell their investment. It has to be a liquid market, a deep market. They must always be able to sell at a normal price. And futures markets enable that. So you can always sell outright, the Bitcoin in this case. But with the future markets, you can also sell and close your position in the futures market. There are several futures markets, and one big one in Chicago, the CME, open since 2017, I think. And the CME, that is a cash-settled futures exchange. So you can sell and buy bitcoins for a price somewhere in the future, to be settled in the future, but all is settled in cash. So you could theoretically sell more than 21 million bitcoins, even if there's not even 21 million bitcoins. So, of course, you need a lot of cash for that, but you could do it, especially in the context of quantitative easing and governments having endless access to the printing presses. That is not a favorable thing. There could be fiat games out there, and that's why it's very, very important to have BACT opening its warehouses today and going live 23rd, I think, of September, with a physically settled futures contract. So in order to sell bitcoins in the future, you actually need to have those bitcoins. If you don't have them, you can't sell them. And that changes the whole game because, first, there can be arbitrage between CME and BACT, between Chicago and New York. If the prices are very different, you just buy and sell at the same time in the future against different prices. It will be like free money. So that will be arbitraged away very soon. And the second thing is, it will be very, very hard to open a short position because if you sell your Bitcoin and you know you have to deliver those Bitcoin, you have to have them, you have to buy them. And when the price goes up, it's not a matter of putting in more fiat. You really need to buy those Bitcoin. So I think people will be very, very cautious shorting that thing.
My personal opinion, I was hearing you talk about the Sharpe ratio and position sizing, and this has been something that I've been kind of shouting from the mountaintops after hearing you talk about it. I personally think this is the elephant in the room for all of financial planners and managers in the world right now. I think this idea is absolutely massive. This whole idea of correlation, Sharpe ratio, position size.
Yes, and it ties into the derivatives pricing as well. So Sharpe ratio is a measure of risk return, a risk-adjusted return. Actually, you divide the return of an asset by the risk, and the risk is usually measured in standard deviation. Now, it's very hard to see assets that have a Sharpe ratio above one, where the risk is smaller than the return. Usually the return is higher than the risk, and you get the return is lower than the risk. So you get a Sharpe ratio of less than one. And in theory, of course, the more risk, the more standard deviation, the more return. And that's what you see in the Sharpe ratio. Now with Bitcoin, it has a superior Sharpe ratio because it has those are all average numbers, but it has average returns of above 200% per year. And the worst loss is about 80% in a year, which is a lot, of course. It's the reason why people don't invest in Bitcoin because, whoa, it has such high volatility. I never understand why people say that because, okay, 80%, that's a lot. And I actually did that three times, right? It did in 2011, 2014, and 2018. All those three times, you see the papers and the mainstream media write about the tulip bubbles and it's all a Ponzi and blah, blah, blah. But it's just an 80% drawdown, and 80% is less than 200%. That's what I wanted to say. The Sharpe ratio is above one. And for a quant, someone who is used to pricing derivatives, that's like a light bulb. Bang, okay, we can use this from very neat mathematical tricks. To keep it simple, it's all about investment sizing, if you see numbers like this. It's the same with poker, by the way. Maybe that's recognizable. It's the Kelly criteria. Depending on the odds that you have, you can size your bet. If your odds are low, if your Sharpe ratio is low, you're not going to bet the farm. You're going to bet a little bit. And if your odds are better, you bet more. For example, size your investment to 50%. You would not have the risk of minus 80%. You would have a risk of minus 40%. That's more or less what stocks would give you. And the return would be not 200%, but would be 100%, which is much, much better. More than stocks would give you. So if you go to the extreme and invest just 1% of your portfolio in Bitcoin and let the other 99% do nothing, keep it cash or something, so only 1% in Bitcoin, that would outperform the S&P 500 over a four-year period for all years in the past 6, 7, 8 years. So every single year, Bitcoin 1%, 99% cash would outperform the S&P 500. Yeah, I think you're right about the elephant in the room. That opens all sorts of doors for arbitrage.
So I was reading a book where they were interviewing Ray Dalio, and Ray was giving his points on how he does his approach. And for people, you know, most people on our show are familiar with Ray Dalio, but if people aren't familiar with Ray Dalio, his personal net worth is anywhere from like $16 to $18 billion. He runs the biggest hedge fund on the entire planet, hundreds of billions of dollars. Ray was asked, okay, so like, what's your secret sauce? And Ray says, well, I believe the holy grail of investing is really kind of two things. It's finding something that has a very high Sharpe ratio, which is what you just described, the highest Sharpe ratio you can find. And then you have to mix it with 10 to 15 uncorrelated, at a minimum, 10 to 15 uncorrelated positions that also have high Sharpe ratios. So when you combine the uncorrelation with very high Sharpe ratios with what you just described, that's how you can optimize a portfolio that minimizes your downside risk, but maximizes your upside return. So we've already established the return relative to the risk. You're measuring volatility with risk, that Bitcoin has outperformed the U.S. stock market, all the commodity indices, the fixed income market, even though central banks are bidding them into oblivion. I mean, you could go on. You can list every single asset. Bitcoin is outperforming them from the Sharpe ratio on every single one of them for the last 5 years without incident in the last 5 years.
I totally agree with Ray Dalio. It's all about the high Sharpe ratio. And Bitcoin has a high Sharpe ratio, and that is not even taking into account the correlation diversification potential that's there. Bitcoin could be that safe haven asset that gold was in the past. There are some studies out there that show this already, that Bitcoin has a negative correlation to equities, for example, and to other assets, to all other assets, basically, which would make it the holy grail, right, of all investments. It has a high Sharpe ratio and negative correlation with all the other assets. However, we haven't had a real financial crisis in the last 10 years. In a way, we haven't been able to really stress test this correlation diversification potential of Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin was made at the beginning of 2009, just after, at the height of the global financial crisis, as a response also to the global financial crisis. So that was the last big dips we saw in equities. And we're actually heading, of course, fast towards the second recession and crisis. Inverted yield curves and all the other measures are pointing to a next recession. And that will be the time that we really test Bitcoin for negative correlation with other assets. And that would make it undeniable for even the most traditional institutional investor.
Interesting. So let's zoom out here. There are $17 trillion of negative yielding bonds in this world. I know you have some very interesting thoughts on how that plays into the Bitcoin thesis. Could you please elaborate?
The negative interest on $17 trillion worth of bonds is, together with the quantitative easing, the reason I am in Bitcoin. That was actually the reason I was actively looking for a high Sharpe ratio, non-correlated asset, a hedge, if you will, against the next crisis. And that's how I came on the path of Bitcoin. I find it amazing, the amount of negative interest rate bonds. It's uncharted waters, for sure. We have never seen this before. I also think it's unsustainable and it has unintended consequences. As a matter of fact, there's a very important report out there. It's an IMF report about deep negative interest rates. And it's not a research, it's a proposal. It's a readily implementable proposal. Deep negative interest rates means -5, -10%. That report is out there, ready to implement. I actually talked to the writers of that report. One of them is very active on Twitter. It's Miles Kimball. Very interesting to see what the intentions are, what the thinking of the central banks is behind those negative interest rates, and especially the deep negative interest rates, because we will go there. In effect, the intention is really good. It's like a bank tax. They're saying, okay, the banks and all the big bad boys, they are getting negative interest rates, so they're earning nothing. But of course, for the public, the retail investor, they cannot go to zero. They'll be at zero, which is low, but still better than all the big investors. That's a way to make it better for the common man. That's the intention. It is a good intention. What's also an argument of that IMF paper is that it's better to go negative interest rate route than to let it all explode, have a recession, and then build it up from there. The losses are bigger in that scenario. So let's go the negative interest rate route. That's one opinion. I think the unintended consequences, like gross misallocation of capital, is making it worse than better. Most people like me, or either an investor or a quant or something, are looking at the markets. They are starting to see the unsustainability of this, because we're talking about 25 to a third of all the bonds out there that are negative yielding at the moment. Of course, you can still buy them and make money. If the interest goes even deeper, you make a lot of money in fair value on those assets. That army of people hedging, not trusting this negative interest rate scenario and hedging their positions accordingly with Bitcoin, that army is going to grow slowly but steadily every day.
Back to the idea that you stated there as far as, well, if people have an expectation that the rates are only going to go lower, then they could buy them and sell them at a profit. It is the definition of the greater fool's theory of investing, where you're entering into a contract that you fully know you're going to lose money on. If you hold it into maturity, you are guaranteed to lose money. It'd be like you and me saying, hey, let's shake. I'm going to give you $100, fully knowing that you're going to give me 95 back in the future when this matures. You're literally signing up to lose money. The only way I can make money in that deal is if I find a fool that's greater than myself. I'm issuing it there at a $5 loss. The only way is if somebody else comes along and is willing to take an even bigger loss. There's just no way that's sustainable. There's no way that's sustainable.
It's the very definition of a Ponzi in a way, right?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it is the definition of a Ponzi scheme. So historically, there's plenty of examples of hyperinflation in the world. So we could go back to the 1920s. That's the most famous one with the mark against gold. And you kind of look at that chart and you can just see this massive printing of the mark through that period of time. I'm kind of curious because if we're measuring the value of Bitcoin compared to all other fiat currencies, this chart looks very similar. The parabolic shoot to the moon kind of printing of fiat in relation to the value of these 21 million Bitcoins that has a fixed supply. I'm kind of curious if you've ever thought about doing any kind of research or that you've heard of any kind of research as to how long that takes to play out because we're dealing with the global supply of fiat versus just the fiat supply of a small country that we've seen in the past. Because we've never seen anything like this on a global scale historically.
Actually, two things. I have one chart out there that compares the Weimar 1923 hyperinflation in Germany with Bitcoin. Really scary how well it tracks that Weimar picture. And the Weimar picture is, as you described it, it's very parabolic, even on a log scale. Last 10 years, Bitcoin tracks that Weimar chart, that hyperinflation chart, perfectly. As a matter of fact, I was looking for some other asset that had the same performance as Bitcoin had the last 10 years. So that did a 10x every 2 years, for example. There was nothing I could find, nothing even close, except this Weimar chart. I think we can add the Venezuela chart and Zimbabwe chart by now. But yeah, on a global scale, it might be even worse. I'm actually doing some research to predict which country will be the first one to adopt Bitcoin, which, I mean, you can calculate which ones are smaller a monetary base than Bitcoin already, which countries don't have large exports, so they don't have the Triffin dilemma that you see very well displayed in the Trump tweets at the moment. U.S. has a big Triffin dilemma. They have a world reserve currency, U.S. dollars. You can print it. That's the advantage. But of course, the high value, the strong U.S. dollar makes it more difficult for the companies like Boeing and Caterpillar to export, because their export will be more expensive for other countries, say for Europe or Japan. So the Triffin dilemma is real, but it's not there for a lot of countries, especially the smaller countries that don't have exports. So you can rank all the 150 countries against those kind of criteria and actually quite easily predict which countries it will be very beneficial for to make the jump to Bitcoin.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/WSB. That's fundrise.com/WSB. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Ally, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. As many of you know, I love studying businesses and networking with business owners. The more I've studied businesses, the more I've realized that starting and scaling your business is easier than ever because of companies like Shopify. Did you know that Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify even helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. What I personally love about Shopify is that it's the turnkey solution to kickstart and grow your business, and they are totally committed to giving you the necessary tools to succeed as a business owner. Plus, they have an award-winning customer support team there to help you every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/WSB. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/WSB now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/WSB.
All right. Back to the show. So in the same context, who would be most at disadvantage to make that jump?
I think the United States has too much to lose to give up their reserve currency position. Same, for example, for Germany. It has too much export to make that jump. If you think about it, the Triffin dilemma is a real monster, and Bitcoin is the solution. So that's one of the big misunderstandings at the moment. I hope gets out of the way soon. I might play a role in that as well. I would really hope that central bankers, the IMF, and all the big banks come together, talk about this situation that's out there now with quantitative easing and negative interest rate yields and maybe the next recession, because the intention, I'm sure, is good. They want to solve it. And Bitcoin, if well explained, could very well be a solution, our only way out to all this. It gets rid of the Triffin dilemma, but you can only do it if everybody does it. So nobody has the disadvantage. So if you can come to an agreement with China, with the US, with Europe, Japan, and all the big countries, the G7, plus China, for the world, that could really mean much. That could be the next step to a better money technology that Bitcoin is, in my opinion. I think if there will be a coalition of countries, it will not be the big countries because they're fighting over a lot of stuff and they have too much to lose. But it could very well be a coalition of smaller companies that go together. And there are some very pro-Bitcoin small companies out there and growing, like Singapore, like Malta, like Estland, Letland, Litauen, small high-tech countries that probably will cooperate.
So Plan B, what is the number one thing that you think people misunderstand about Bitcoin?
Yeah, that is a tough question. This being an investor podcast, I think one of the big misunderstandings is why Satoshi left. If you know the answer to that question, if you research it and know the answer to that question, you protect yourself against a lot of misunderstanding because there is a lot of scammers and fraud and misinformation out there. Why did Satoshi leave? Why is it important not to have a leader? No CEO, no corporation, no government, no pre-mine. If you understand why that is and why you need just a peer-to-peer network, a peer-to-peer mathematical protocol, and some energy to protect it, you know the answers to a lot of things in Bitcoin.
So one of the last questions that we always like to ask is, where can the investor go and make their own informed opinion about a topic? Where should the novice investor go to seek the best unbiased information?
I would certainly advise them to go look into their circle of friends and family who is already a Bitcoin expert or knows about Bitcoin to teach from them. That goes a lot faster. But of course, you don't know how good they are. So I'll give some resources. Please read the white paper. The white paper is a must read. If you haven't read it, go read it. It's only 9 pages, including the references. It's very concise and easily written, and it has everything in it. It will make a lot of things clear and you won't be sensitive to scammers anymore. So read the white paper. Then Seyfeddin Amous's book, The Bitcoin Standard, of course, is the Bitcoin Bible. You should read it. It's longer, but it's a good read. And I would say all the podcasts that are out there right now, your podcast, Stefan Levera has a nice podcast, lots out there, What Bitcoin Did. Things are going so fast that books are too late. articles also. Podcasts are really a great thing. I never listened to a podcast before I was in Bitcoin. Now I listen to a Bitcoin podcast every day in the car. That's really good. Make sure you have the right ones. So the ones I mentioned, that's important for investors, but also for journalists. There is a site out there. It's called Hive.one, Hive.one. And it has a list. It's a sort of Google for who is who in Bitcoin land. So you can see who's number 1, 2, 3. It goes to 1,000. But if you want to know something about Bitcoin, follow those people first. And then you can spread out to others. But make sure you follow those people because they know they are mathematically chosen to be on that list because they did a lot of podcasts, they wrote a lot of stuff, and they are respected by the community.
I absolutely love that last point. It is so important that you get your information from the right people. We'll have a link to that Hive site that has that listing. And I'm telling you, folks, make sure you follow the right people. Just don't follow some random person that you come across on Twitter because they might be trying to push or shill something that is in their self-interest and not yours. And I think that when you go to a person like Adam Back or Nick Szabo, these guys that actually have contributions to writing the code for how the encryption works, trust me, you're going to get a much more quality response and understanding as to how things are happening. What's the vantage point to look at that's not going to get you in trouble? Because there's a lot of different interests out there in this community, mostly because people don't understand what it is that they're doing. So I would tell you that to hyper focus on the top few people that actually are the ones that are creating and designing all of this. Plan B, fantastic comment there. I'll have that in the show notes. Please give people a handoff to yourself and anything else that you want to put out there for the community about yourself.
So you can find me on Twitter, Plan B at $100 trillion. There is a Medium article with all the stuff and the model described in it out there. It's on the pinned tweet. If you want to calculate Dr. Flow yourself, play with the models, there's a GitHub as well. It's under the pinned tweet with all the models and data available for the quants that love to do it themselves. Yeah, I think that's about it.
Well, Plan B, we can't thank you enough for coming on the show. Your research is just fascinating. It's so excited to see somebody. I'm so excited to see somebody come into the community and just drop these really high quality papers with a lot of analysis in there, a lot of math in there. And it's just really exciting to be able to chat with you. So thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you.
All right, guys. So at this point in time in the show, we'll play a question from the audience. And this question comes from Adam.
Hey guys, I'm a huge fan of your podcast. Thank you so much for your amazing work. So I recently listened to Ray Dalio's The Impact of China's Growth on the World Economy interview. During the discussion, Dalio describes China as the rising power that challenges the US, the existing world power. Here are my questions. How should one invest considering China's rising power? Would you suggest investing directly in Chinese stocks? If yes, which one would you consider? Thank you so much and have a wonderful day.
That's a great question. I think it's important not to overestimate the effect of the rise of China for you as a stock investor. The rise of China is known by stock investors in general, just like the rise of India is known. Based on the Shiller PE, you can expect something like a 6 to 7% return investing in the Chinese stock market, which is definitely not expensive, but it's also not very cheap. So, it's a valuation that reflects both the potential in China, but also the risk of investing in a country where regulation is very different than what we're used to in the West. So, to your question, I personally only own one Chinese stock, and that is Alibaba. And this is not a recommendation by any means. I also bought the stock at a different price than what it is today. But it's more a bet on e-commerce in general, which of course is heavily dependent on GDP growth, which is favorable in China compared to the West. But it's also because I think that China has an advantage in collecting data, which is very important for big tech companies. And I think that's fundamental for the very structure of what Alibaba is trying to achieve. But it's important for me to underline that this is not a bet on China per se, but on the specific company. So, keeping that in mind, I do not recommend that you invest in China for the sake of investing in China, if the sole reason is that you think it would prosper and grow stronger. If you were to target specific Chinese stocks, you would need to understand the Chinese culture better, as it is to a large extent a closed economy compared to many other economies. You could buy a Chinese ETF tracking the stock index, and I can't see why it won't make a decent return, say, if you hold it for at least a decade. But if you do, I have a few words of caution. Some of them are quite expensive in management fee, which they shouldn't be for a passive managed index. And another issue is that the market-weighted funds are tilted heavily into financials. Up to 50% is not uncommon, which poses a risk in itself if you decide to go for a specific Chinese ETF. So, to sum up, yes, like Redalio, I'm bull long-term on China. I do think there's a paradigm shift, but I do not invest differently, and it doesn't change my overall strategy.
So for me, I think investing in China is fairly straightforward. First, the ETF approach that Stig mentioned earlier is the simplest way to get exposure. Watch the fees, like Stig said, and also make sure that there's not too much exposure to the financial companies. If you're feeling more adventurous and looking for individual companies, I'd tell you to focus on three things. The first thing would be find a company that originated in China. The second thing that I would tell you is look for companies that are fairly large in market cap, but still have room to grow. And then the third thing I would tell you is look for companies that have government leadership entrenched into the company. So companies like Tencent and Alibaba are perfect examples of businesses that started in China. They're large and still have even more room to grow, and they have tons of government entrenchment. I know this sounds really simple, but let's face the facts. China is a dictatorship that is dressed up in a capitalist costume. So if you're going to try to participate in those markets, I think the best way to try and achieve that is through that three simple step process. If you're buying individual companies and if you want to do the ETFs, that's fine. So as a side note, I don't personally have any investments in China, but Adam, for asking such a great question, we have an online course called our Intrinsic Value Course that we're going to give you completely for free. Additionally, we have a filtering and momentum tool, which we call TIP Finance. We're going to give you a year-long subscription to TIP Finance completely for free. Leave us a question at asktheinvestors.com. That's asktheinvestors.com. If you're interested in these tools, simply go to our website, theinvestorspodcast.com. And you can see right there in our top level navigation, there's links to TIP Finance and also the TIP Academy, where you'd find the Intrinsic Value course.
All right, guys, that was all that Preston and I had for this week's episode of the Investors Podcast. We see each other again next week.
Thank you for listening to TIP. To access our show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.